California down to Santa Maria, which is where Vandenberg Air Force Base was, with a 300 baud modem, and we were all ecstatic that the whole that the whole communication took place. It's come a long way since then.
It sure has. Yeah. It really has. And here we are, taking advantage.
Yeah,
here we are.
Yeah. Ah, our fearful leader has shown up.
Hi, Marco.
Hello.
Let me make sure that I'm set up. I'm a bit in transition because I just got back from a preschool that we're thinking of sending, or we're planning our younger daughter. And after that, we were all hungry, so we grabbed a bite. And
how did it go?
Yeah, we've been there a number of years ago because our older daughter was there, and I think it went well. I think that I didn't find anything to be concerned about. They seem to have things under control and have their research and evidence-based approaches, and seem to be attentive and attuned to the children as well. I think it'll work out there. It was good for our older daughter. Even though we're homeschooling her now, we sent her to preschool there in kindergarten. Mm. So she got some 1 foot in that world.
So she's joining the consensus reality.
Well, we'll see about that.
I don't know. My grandson goes to a daycare here and not far from us. It's a whole other reality. I don't know if it's consensus or not, but it's its own little world. I can assure you that. But he likes it.
Cool.
TJ.
Hello, hey, TJ.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
It's always good to hear. Yeah.
Did you leave work early to join us?
No, I'm on vacation this week.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
So I'll be here Thursday too, I hope. That's
vacation? Why?
Vacation, imagine that.
What the heck is that?
Right?
That's one of the things I miss about not working, you know. Yeah, not getting a vacation.
Probably busier now than ever, right?
I am. I have absolutely zero time. This is the whole thing. You know?
It's about 5 after. Should we wait another minute? I don't know if Doug's going to join us. He said, I don't think he said we were going to.
Yeah, he didn't seem to be able to at this time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody else will be here, so we could get started for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Just before we start, I want to thank you, Marco. I dropped some birthday hints, and I got it. Awesome! Awesome collection of stuff.
Talking about synchronicity. Well, there's something musical about it, and maybe we can talk about that too. The poetics of synchronicity, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And John, you suggested a text that we read today.
I did.
We also had some seed questions and background reading and other input stuff in the forum.
Right.
And so I'll let you lead us off if you'd like to begin.
Okay, thank you. I'm really excited about this. I've been going through lots of different books and, you know, extracting certain anecdotes and stories. And I posted that article by Eric Weiss about definitions for synchronicity, mm-hmm. and how perplexing it is for us moderns to deal with something that emerged out of the madrigal. And I also reviewed the dialogue with Garfield and Carrie Welch. And she said something, listening to it again, more things popped out. She said, she talks about pink noise and how pink noise produces order and disorder. And so that's what I would like to do. I would like to create some pink noise. She also talks about each person lives in their own reality. And then there's the consensus reality. But that's not the reality they live in. I thought that was very interesting, listening to that again. And we've all shared it and we've discussed it somewhat. So I want to elaborate a little bit on some of these themes. And I want to share a few anecdotes, you know, gleaned from the vast literature. And I wanted to actually do some modeling to work on our individual maps of time. And that would be structured. I would ask a few questions from each of you. And then we could create a map. Each of you can create a map of time. And then hopefully we can reflect a little bit on a possible meta map. This is very ambitious, and it is an experiment. I've never quite done anything like this before. But I think it might be of use to us as we are exploring synchronicity and serendipity and finding new definitions. I think we need to also have an experiential component to all of this. Doug posted something about, he asked about, are there any updates for Jung's model or upgrades for Jung's model? And that's what I'm hoping we'll do today. I hope we can upgrade. So I'll start off with just making a few remarks and some anecdotes about what synchronicity could be or what serendipity is. And then we can do like an open frame, have a free for all, and you know, each of you can express whatever you want to about this topic. And then maybe we can have that structured part I mentioned where we work on an actual map, do some actual modeling. Take about 20 minutes. I think there are three of us on this call besides myself. And so I think it would take about 20, 25 minutes. And then we could spend the rest of the call doing a free-for-all again, reflecting upon this experience. So are you guys all with me?
Works for me.
Okay. Thank you for your attention. I just wanted to start with, this is from Alan Combs and Mark Holland's book, Synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And I think all of you, since you're all scholars here, would relate to this concept that author Kessler came up with called the library angel. An excellent example of the angel at work was reported to Kessler in 1972 by Dame Rebecca West, who was researching a specific episode that took place during the Nuremberg war crime trials. And this is a quote from Rebecca West. "I looked at the trials in the library and was horrified to find they published in a form almost useless to the researcher. They are abstracts and are cataloged under arbitrary headings. After hours of search, I went along the line of shelves to an assistant librarian and said, 'I can't find it. There's no clue. It may be in any of these volumes.' I put my hand on one volume and took it out and carelessly looked at it. It was not only the right volume, but I had opened it at the right page." I think that's extremely amusing. I think, Ed, you were talking about this experience, quite common to you. Mm. I also wanted to, another quotation, another anecdote from another interesting book called Extraordinary Knowing. This is by Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer, Science, Skepticism, and the Inexplicable Powers of the Mind. She was a psychotherapist, and she had a lot of interesting clients. And this is a description that one of her clients had. "I know things, and it mystifies me how I know them. Sometimes it terrifies me. It starts with getting a good read on things. I'm intuitive, but lots of people are intuitive. It didn't get really scary until I was in graduate school. I was in my third year of PhD work. I had a good fellowship. My professors thought well of me. I had an area for dissertation that built on the work of one professor, someone I liked a lot, very smart, but very gruff. He was teaching a seminar. One day, he'd given us a problem to work out, very complicated. I took it down like everyone else. Then I said the answer, just said it, the right answer, to four decimal places. It just came to me. It just seemed natural to say it. It was a disaster. The professor swore I must have stolen his notes. That was crazy. There was no way I could have gotten those notes. But it was just as crazy that I came up with the answer. After that, he wouldn't work with me anymore. The other students stopped trusting me. It got so bad I had to find another university where I could do my dissertation research. I've been moving ever since. I get afraid people might start attacking me for things that I shouldn't know. Now I move before things blow up. What happens is I'll suddenly know something. Like I'll know an experiment won't work. I'll know some data analysis is faulty. The more I let on what I know, the more obvious it gets that I don't have any basis for knowing. It's just an idea that comes to me, but I know. I can't tell how powerful the sensation is. Maybe you know what it's like. It's spooky. It scares me. I want to be normal. So, I want to be normal. I think everyone wants to be normal. I think we have a kind of deep fear about being too weird or too deviant. For the consensus reality, so we have to keep it in check. But as we've been discussing this this mental deficient phase and looking at Gebser and the integral, whatever that could be, and this ability to harmonize these brain waves, the EEG, I think Carrie was mapping across from the Gebser's model to the EEG. I think that's very suggestive of how we might start playing around with models for serendipity and synchronicity, what these odd kinds of, so Jung talks about an acausal connecting principle. But as Eric Weiss says in that essay, that's not very satisfying. It sort of sounds good, but it pretty much says nothing at all. It's a tricky way for the modern mind to sort of obfuscate what these kinds of experiences could possibly come from. So I'm open to any feedback. There are a few more stories that I think might be of use, but I'm also interested in what you guys are coming up with. One more quote. Also, I've been using synchronicity and serendipity almost synonymously. I've been oscillating back and forth in these two concepts. I think there are slight differences, and I think maybe we'll elaborate on what those differences could be. But I think Caleb, I think that's his name, Nassim Taleb Caleb, who wrote The Black Swan. He speaks about serendipity a lot. It's sort of accidental learning, but some of that learning isn't necessarily accidental. And he speaks of, if you think that the inventions we see around us came from sitting in a cubicle and concocting them according to a timetable, think again. Almost everything of the moment is the product of serendipity. And he lists whole lots of inventions, from penicillin to Velcro, which came out of what he calls serendipity. So, who wants to start first? I just want to open this up to have like a free for what do you call it, Ed? It's not a free for all, but
brainstorm.
All over the place. We can go all over. We can go all over the place for as long as we need to, and mm-hmm. then I can do a kind of structured, formal activity for all of us. And it's a group activity. You'll be asked as an individual about your map of time. I'll ask you a few questions, and then I think we can each. Take a step back and reflect upon our different maps. Mm. And then we can have another free-for-all. So it's free for all over the place, some structure, and then all over the place. That's sort of my plan. We'll see what happens. And hopefully at the end of the our call today, we can update ourselves. And I would be delighted if some serendipitous learnings happened in this session today.
I know that they will.
They always do, don't they? Yeah. Yeah. Can I say something here right off the bat? One of the things that struck me about when I first started reading Eric's paper here, as you all know, I have a problem with modernity and postmodernity, and I don't know what else I all have a problem with. But it took me a while to realize that he wasn't talking to me when he was writing this. And I always read this as if the whoever's writing it is speaking to me. And then I realized, well, he's not speaking to me because I don't have this view of the world that he's cautioning us about at the beginning, this modern view that is so absolutely at base materialistic that it doesn't allow for these other things. I come from a very different, you know, my history's been much different than that. And so I don't see the world that way. And once I realized that, I said, oh, okay, well, this is fine. Because it's like you said in your second antidote, you can say things and do things. I mean, my antidote's about books falling off of shelves in bookstores. I know what it's like to instill fear in your co-conversationalists. You say something like that and terror enters into people's eyes because that cannot be. You're making this up. This is just a story. Well, of course it's a story, but I'm not making it up. You see, my whole feeling is that good stories, you can't make up. You know, the best ones happen and you see them. You know, reality is much stranger than fiction. Fiction is always the controlled attempt to kind of come to terms with things. That's how I see it anyhow. So when I'm going through here, I realize, well, that's all well and good, unless, for example, you're Arthur Young. And when you think about Young, obviously Weiss and Young didn't have any real interaction. But if you start with the whole idea that light is conscious and purposeful, then you get to serendipitous places very, very quickly. You get to things that are synchronistic very, very quickly because they actually can't be otherwise. Now, one of the things that out of science that probably has impressed me or stuck with me or made, you know, one of the hardest hits on me overall has been Bell's theorem. And it has been proved in the meantime, and that is non-locality. Two particles that were once related that are now separated, it doesn't matter. They can be on other sides of the universe, and if something happens to one, it happens to the other. There's just effect over space, if you want to look at it that way, in zero time. And if you couple a thought like that, well, it's more than a thought. It's actually a theorem. But if you couple with it the idea that, like Carl Sagan said, you know, we're made of star stuff, the Big Bang and all those particles out there, well, then every particle in my body has been somewhere else at some other time. I'm connected with all. If I take that seriously, which I do, then I'm constantly being affected by things that I have absolutely no conscious relation to. And that can either scare you, which it does a lot of people, or it can comfort you, which it does me. Because it's like, well, okay, I'm literally never alone, even though sometimes I would like to be. But then again, the imp in me always says, but if I'm affecting myself, I could be wreaking havoc elsewhere as well. You know, this is not a one-sided thing. You know, we're all involved in this together. So, I never had that problem, if you will. It's in quotes that needs to be mad that it can't be part. It's all part of my world, and I consider myself here currently 2017 in a modern world. Not in the modern world in the sense that he's talking about with this materialistic bent, but the moment you give that up and the moment you acknowledge that maybe there is something, a more, maybe there is a spiritual, or maybe it is just consciousness. And I use just in quotation marks there. The once you open it up to there's a non-physical reality as well as a physical reality, then a lot of these things become very, very normal. And what surprises me is when it doesn't quite work that way. And when I'm off looking, I say, well, actually, something should have gone on here, or something should have happened, because that's what I would have expected. You develop a whole new expectation horizon, so to speak. And that was the thing that struck me, that towards the end, it was like, well, okay. But even in a physicist's view of the world, Jung's, for example, all of this is very normal, which is why Jung was not part of the mainstream, our everyday, well-accepted, orthodox scientific community. And he was also looked at as askance and kept at a distance. But it is necessary, I think, to ease a lot of people into this. You know? So those are my two cents.
Great. Someone, I think it's Michael Murphy, who wrote Future of the Body.
Yeah.
He calls it metanormal rather than mm-hmm. paranormal.
Yeah.
But I so agree that what's normal and what's paranormal can vary from day to day and from person to person. Mm-hmm. And that what we may be calling paranormal now might be the new normal. If enough people mm-hmm. had those kinds of experiences and naturalized them or made them palatable or had some sort of cognitive framework, mm-hmm. then they could probably expect to use them in a creative way. So thank you for that, Ed. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make one more comment, because I think Doug mentioned something about, he sent a, I think Waking Life, a little bit from Waking Life, which is a movie I really enjoyed about a postmodern couple. But then, and I thought it was very amusing, because the dialogue between the two sounded to me very much like what the modern mind does with the synchronistic or the magical. It tries to operationalize it. And I noticed that in myself. You know, these are great. I want more of them. I want them to become more effective and efficient for me. Because if I can make this work, man. But it doesn't happen that way. I found lots of misfires and backfires. And a lot of these synchronistic events are definitely learnings, but they're not necessarily pleasant. They can also create a lot of cognitive dissonance. So thank you for
isn't that the kind of the moral of the Sorcerer's Apprentice? That's, I'm an absolute Disney disliker, but I like that one.
That's another cultural metaphor we can mark, the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, Sorcerer's Apprentice.
I went in the macro-social approach, of course.
Oh, really? Oh, wait a minute.
Surprise, surprise. I like where Eric Weiss went. I like where he ended up, actually, where he's replacing synchronicity with consciousness itself. He distinguishes between the pre-modern and the modern. And it's exactly what Mircea Eliade did with the difference between the traditional man and the modern man. And the traditional man is operating out of the mythical circle, if you will, and the modern man is operating out of the mental arrow of time. So the traditional man puts hope in his sense making of the past by the renewal, the archetype always coming back. The king and the priestess go up into the upper chamber of the temple and the crops come back and you kind of wipe the slate clean every year. And so that's the hope in the mythical circle. Then the hope in the mental arrow is, of course, it's really a myth, but progress. And you're accumulating knowledge and you're learning how to supposedly get better, avoid the mistakes that you make. You're in neither the circle nor the arrow are you carrying a weight of the disasters of the past. You're always putting it into a kind of meaning and sense-making schema for that. So Eliade says the traditional man has a terror of history. History as what Toynbee would say is one damn thing after another. But in order to get rid of the terror of history, he just goes in the cycle and renews it. Modern man, I would say, has a terror of mystery, because your progress, in order to have progress, you have to be able to know that the patterns and the laws you're discovering as you're moving forward in time are working for you, that you can apply the lessons of one thing to the next one and get somewhere. And if you take that certainty away, if you take that, turn the predictabilities back into probabilities, your meaning system collapses. That's why the fear of synchronicity, you know, kind of strikes against all of that. Oh, you know, what do I do now type of thing. I just thought that was very interesting. It's the same. It's Gebser, Eliade, and Weiss here are saying the same things. And it's that switch back and forth even between the theological, for lack of better, and technological.
So it's the fear of synchronicity and the terror of mystery.
Terror of mystery, which parallels Eliade's terror of history in the traditional man.
And terror of history in the traditional man, would that be because they're sort of fast forwarding into the historical modern and it's freaking them out?
No, it's an avoidance. He would say it's an avoidance of the weight of the disasters and disappointments of events. And if you don't have to carry that from year to year, if you can kind of renew it and come back and reinforce the legitimacy of the archetypes, you kind of get away from that.
I got you. Yeah. I misread you. I see what you're talking about.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
So TJ, you described a circle, the mythical circle, an arrow, the arrow of time, the arrow of progress, the mythical circle corresponding to what Gebser would call the mythic structure of consciousness, the modern arrow of time corresponding to what he would call the mental. What's beyond that?
That's the very interesting question that I've been kicking around. I just read a article online it wasn't Collingwood's stuff, but it was somebody who was writing an essay about R.G. Collingwood as a philosopher. I think he wrote The Idea of History. Mm-hmm. And the question, and my whole theme has, you know, been about how do you use history but then kind of transcend it. According to Collingwood, a historian is forbidden to ask that question. He's dealing with the evidence from the past, and that's where his information comes from, and that's the scheme that he sets up. What is beyond that is not a historical question, according to Collingwood. But Spengler, Aurobindo, Gebser, all these guys are asking that very question, what comes next? Mm-hmm.
So who said that history is a nightmare we're trying to wake up from?
Oh, I don't know. You got me.
But it's sort of that. How do we use history in order to transcend it?
Pretty much.
And you would say then that Aurobindo and Gebser and Bergson, and who's that other guy, that integralist, that's so, Eliade, so they're all working with this, they have a future orientation, and sort of they can look into the past and in the future. Sort of at the same time, I'm looking at Arthur Kestrel, wrote a book called Janus, talked about the Janus-faced God who can look into the future and the past
at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's another interesting metaphor.
But it's consciousness students who are doing that. It's not historians. History is a very mental structure thing. And then Gebser points it out, of course, the most directly, but it's kind of a theme in all of these readings. History is for a people who have discovered chronology and causation and the need to arrange things in that spatial time grid, the need to spatialize time. Before that, you have, again, the myths, the archetypes. And before that, in the magical consciousness structure, you're not dealing with past, present, future, or time like this. You don't even need a sense of history in that sense.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And a cultural analyst, like you said, Gebser was sort of a hybrid, perhaps.
Yeah. Without going into hero worship, because I just read that thread, you know. But yeah, he, Gebser is calling us to incorporate, what did Ed say before, expectation horizon. He's broadening that. He's calling us to if we recognize the archaic spirit, let's say, as a, again, for lack of a better word, as like a theological phase, and then the magical structure would be a technological phase. Now I'm aware of nature and I've got to use these things and I'm going to kill these animals so that, you know, my villagers and children can live and make those kinds of covenants. And then the mythical is another theological phase and the mental being another technological phase. And Gebser's kind of saying, instead of keep, it's not going with these waves, incorporate that. Mm-hmm. Use all the wisdom for that and go forward with that. Another thought real quick, I'll throw this out. Because I've been reading also Merlin Donald's Stages of Mind, which again kind of maps onto Gebser's structure.
I like him a lot, Merlin Donald.
Yeah, he's cool. Is very interesting. I can't imagine, if you look at it historically, I can't imagine the magical structure of consciousness, relatively speaking, lasting all that long. You have a mythical structure that I think agrarian civilization gave a boost to, but I think it probably predates that. I think the fireside chats and the modeling and rehearsing of skills that you need to survive in the magical, I think those turn very quickly into the cosmologies of myth. Then you have this long mythical period. Then you have a mental structure. If we start from Petrarch on the mountain and go to Einsteinian relativity at the most, that's only 600 years. The mythical structure is lasting at least tens of thousands of years before that. There's a hope then if we're really going to efficiently incorporate all of that, that the integral can last indefinitely.
Something Eric, I don't know, maybe it was Eric Weiss, didn't he speak of Petrarch's experience on the mountaintop as a synchronistic kind of event? Sort of
he might have, I don't
capsulized know. Yeah, the modern, the waking of the modern, being able to take perspective from that mountaintop.
But there's also, mentions that in his
also I just wanted to point out Merlin Donald, you just mentioned him, TJ, and I'm not sure where he fits. Is he he's a biologist, right? Or is he an anthropologist? Or is he a historian? I don't know.
Psychologist, I think.
Yeah.
He's not.
None of the above.
All of the above. He's an interdisciplinary studies, which is also good.
I like to use the word transdisciplinary because it
there
sounds
you go.
So much fancier.
Can I interject just one little thing?
Please.
Would both of you guys please put all of those references that you've made in the wiki so that we can actually read them? Sometimes my old ears don't get names properly.
Do you remember all those?
I can't. I can't write fast enough. Just stack the books up beside you when you're talking. And tell what they are.
Some of them are online, though.
I don't want to hear about your personal problem.
But
I'm obviously a bound guy here. So,
Mark, do you have any reflections to share with us or comments? Any summaries?
I don't have a summary. I feel like there's not exactly one out there. I'm looking for some sense of a whole, though. Some sense of how these strands interconnect, how they might themselves be synchronous or synchronistic. I'm going to start with a personal reflection on the term, because it didn't come out of nowhere, but it wasn't on my radar. I don't really think about synchronicity very much. I haven't given it much thought. It hasn't been, as Eric Weiss put in his paper, a matter of concern for me. Not the label in any event, not the term itself. But now that, since we were planning to talk about it today, I began thinking about it and read the paper, read the various posts on the forum, and things started coming to mind. Like just the act of holding a thought or holding an inquiry open began to, in a sense, almost coalesce meaning around it. So I could begin to see interconnections between things that I've read, I've seen, conversations I might have had a while ago, somebody who visited my house the other day. And that began to create a sense of synchronicity around the synchronicity. So a sort of meta synchronicity, but it was, and it wasn't intentional, nor was it something that just happened spontaneously without my involvement. So there was some aspect, some role I had to play in that experience emerging, or at least kind of coming to the surface, if not really occurring in a sort of full blown way with, you know, books falling off of shelves or what have you. We're reading different thinkers. We have different conversations and threads going on. Part of what has been on my mind has been the upcoming delve into Sloterdijk's second volume in his Spheres trilogy, which is called Globes. And without going all the way into that, one thing I think might be relevant to this conversation is that, you know, we've discussed the idea or the meaning potentially of that metaphor of a sphere, of a globe or an orb or that round shape. I don't want to necessarily focus on that, but part of what I'm learning through this return to Sloterdijk and the process of grappling, you know, why am I reading this? What do I want to get out of it? How does it relate to everything else? Part of what I'm learning is that there is a matter of concern that Sloterdijk is focusing on, which he's discussing in terms of these spherical shapes, but can be looked at in a way that doesn't rely upon the geometry necessarily, that particular form. And that's that, and we'll talk, I'm sure, about this on Thursday, is that the matter of concern is the whole. It's the world as a whole, or life as a whole, reality as a whole. There's some attempt in the history of Western metaphysics, as Sloterdijk is looking into it, but really we could look at this also from the mythological perspective, that idea of a magic of a circle, and even the modern, there's an attempt to relate to the whole, understand the whole, conceptualize the whole. In the history of Western metaphysics, as Sloterdijk I think is going to unpack it, control the whole. There's a motif of empire, of totalization, and of using the powers that are gained through our experiential learning through history to not only enclose ourselves in a totality, but to transcend that totality at the same time. And this is kind of the weird thing that he starts to get into in terms of describing the contradictions, I think, and I don't know if he's going to use this term exactly, but let's say even just the internal conflicts in this project. So when I think about what the matter of concern is with synchronicity, it has something to do with the whole. It has something, there's some indication when a synchronistic event happens that something bigger is happening than I'm aware of or able to conceptualize. Something bigger is making sense that transcends my horizon, my context of conception or understanding. And that's part of, I think, what might be so terrifying to the, you know, mental, the purely mental mind, or the conventional mind or consensus reality mind, at least relative to our
cultural space. I think that's exact.
Exact.
I think it's exact, because it either reinforces that worldview or it threatens it.
Mm-hmm. So that sense that there's a horizon beyond your worldview is incredibly threatening, particularly if that worldview is really wrapped up with your own sense of survival. Mm-hmm. And So the way that we think the whole is important, and I think that the notion that we use a particular spatial metaphor or temporal metaphors, and that these are not just ways that we kind of describe them theoretically after the fact, but they're constitutive in some way of our experience of the phenomena.
Can I text message?
That's something to pay attention to, because that's not like I think I've been saying on the forum, or have been trying to, like, that's not representational. We're not just standing back as subjects creating a map of reality, the object, to better use it, but we're looking in the space prior to that conceptualization at the thing itself. And so the thing itself is, I think, what is the matter of concern, and how we understand that thing. We can call it consciousness, we can call it reality, there may be discourses around that point of coalescence. I think that's where synchronicity it sort of comes into the picture. And I want to say one more thing about it. I said at the outset that synchronicity itself has not been a matter of concern, but rather the whole is a matter of concern. And I want to propose maybe a way of understanding synchronicity that would maybe sort of include the mythological sense of some kind of beings or some kind of forces, intelligences beyond our own that are conspiring to organize reality in a certain way. Beyond then also the modern denial of realities that are outside of its global, geometric, mathematical, scientific worldview, and ask whether or not we could look at synchronicity as something that's very normal, that's happening all the time. Like, it's happening in an atom, it's happening in social organization, it's happening in our brains, it's happening in certainly cultural productions, art, music, scientific discoveries. I mean, there always has to be some coming together of entities, patterns into greater wholes. So if it's happening all the time, but then we have these special experiences where it seems to happen in a way that transcends what we understand to be normal, what if that's just an aspect of a larger reality, a more whole reality, a higher level holon, to use Kessler's term, which Wilbur also picks up on, that we're getting a glimpse into. So we're getting a view of a larger whole that's working together synchronistically with correspondences in time and space, and maybe just even beyond the arrow of time, so that we would have to understand time differently to understand how a synchronistic event is actually normal from the perspective of a postmodern or integral worldview. So I think that's may or may not lead to a particular path for the conversation, or just kind of add to the everywhere all over the place. But that's how I'm relating to it at this time.
I wanted to respond to that. You're talking about the part and the whole, and we've been playing around with fractals, and it seems to me that the fractal sort of emphasizes that the whole reiterates in the part. And I think that's another metaphor we can put on the table, mm-hmm. Along with those topo-dimensional, the limnus gate, the Möbius strip, the Klein bottle. I just think it's fun for us to put out all these metaphors, and also we can create other metaphors. One of the books that I just comes to me that I think is resonates with what you were just talking about is The Trickster and the Paranormal by George Hansen. And I think something that I just opened this up in the page I turned to, it talks about the middle area goes by several labels. Liminality, interstitiality, Is that it? Interstitiality? I can't pronounce it. Oh. Transitional space.
Interstitiality?
Yeah, interstitiality.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Transitional space betwixt and between anti-structure. And he also talks about Aristotelian logic, and the principle of identity, and the law of the excluded middle. Well, who made up this law anyway? And this is what I think the trickster challenges is it really upsets the apple cart. And something that you said, Ed, last week, something about there's the evolutionary, the developmental, and there's also the phasal. Mm-hmm. I thought that phasal part was very interesting and like fractilic, mm-hmm. if that's a word. And I think what Carrie Welch is saying, if we get finer and finer grain, granularity, mm-hmm. Then we start to tap into the timelessness. And what's before time is timelessness. And it's that oscillation, I think, that it's in those in-betweens that usually, that's where we find these synchronistic events often appear, these anomalies. And this was really interesting to me. And I'm encouraged because if it's okay with you guys, we're almost an hour into this call. Mm-hmm. If I could switch gears a little bit and put on my modeler's cap, I would like to start working with gathering some data from you guys. This is for my big ultimate research project, qualitative research. I'm very attracted to a grounded action theory. There's a problem in your community and you're a member of that community, you can gather high quality data that isn't ad hoc or arbitrary, and that we can use that data to ground our theory. And this is very important to me. I probably repeated myself way too many times about how important it is to ground this stuff. So anyway, I'd like to proceed further, unless there's some more comments out there that haven't been articulated yet that you want to toss in. How does everyone feel?
That's fine with me, John. And just one small note. Sure. Marco was talking about that the whole, and every time you even remotely tap into it, there's this numinous experience. You realize that there's something that's so much bigger than me that it is very intimidating. And if you do that temporarily, that wholeness becomes infinity. And there's a very interesting book on mathematicians that make that their focus of study, and almost all of them go insane.
Yeah, Cantor.
Yeah, Cantor. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a classic example of this. I'll dig that out. Pick it up on
Infinity the. Godel starved himself.
Today. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They all just lose it.
Is this a warning?
Well, it points to the importance of filters. But go ahead.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So there is something very real about that. There is something very existential about that. There's something very serious about that. And as long as, you know, we're always aware, and I think that's why I think Marco's point is so well taken. Synchronicity does have to do with that whole. It's a little glimpse of something huge that's beyond it that I don't really necessarily want to deal with right now. You know, this is, you know, we're talking about something that's much bigger than just fits into our head. This is why, and I think this is true of all people, anybody that has a very strong belief system, fundamentalist Christians, again, they'll always tell you what God's thinking. You know, if they ever even came close to intuiting what God might be, their heads would explode, you know, because it doesn't fit in there. You can't get it in your skull. And it becomes very, and that is the other side of a lot of tales that are told in that direction that we might read in places and things like that. But it's a very real thing. It's a very serious thing. And I think that's something we all need to always be aware of, that, you know, it, we may have a lot of fun gallivanting out towards the edge to see what's over there, but there's a lot of people that aren't necessarily going to come holding hands with us as we skip up to the abyss, you know?
That's the difference Cantor said between absolute infinity and actual infinity.
Infinity, yeah, among others.
More than one infinity out there.
Yes, yes. I'll have to dig that out. So I'll put that on the list, too.
Fascinating. I just before we start this process, I think it'll be like 5 minutes each person, and the total would be about 20 minutes. And I think it's really, in this kind of process, there's something useful about listening to another person's process. I've done this with Ed and Marco. Mm-hmm. We've had several sessions using clean language. I don't think, TJ, I've inquired about certain processes online a little bit.
Right.
But this will be like doing it live, which is a challenge for me because I have the benefit of verbal and nonverbal because I can see you guys. And so I want to ask you if you have any question for me about this process before we begin.
I do, John. So would the desired outcome be to come to some kind of meta model of time drawing from our individual models of time? Is that what you're looking to create?
I don't think I'm going to ask you for a desired outcome, but if you have one, that's cool. I could. Would you like me to do that? I mean,
no, I was asking if that was yours.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in, well, first of all, the issue, which is clarifying synchronicity. And what could that be for us? That would be, and what I would like for the group would be a very rich learning experience that will be of use and delight to you. And that's what I want for myself as well. So I know what I want. I want a really rich learning experience, and I want each of you to have a rich learning experience. And I believe modeling is a way of creating the conditions whereby that can happen. And I believe serendipity and synchronicity are often accompanying or, you know, these rich learning experiences. So getting clearer and also accepting how fuzzy it all is of great interest to me. And I also believe our civilization, Gandhi, I think, said, someone said, what do you think about civilization? And he said, I think it's a good idea. So I don't think we've quite arrived yet at civilization. But I think if we do, it will be because there were enough people who cared enough about these shared communal events like ours that could stimulate these serendipities, so we can go into the crack in the cosmic egg and we can come back and reorient ourselves in a consensus reality and share something that's useful. I know I'm not wanting to get too caught up in the hero with 1,000 faces because I know that a lot of feminists are very suspicious of the hero's journey. But I still want a hero's journey. There's a part of me that's still into that. So, is there anything else anyone wants to ask me about this process before we begin?
Okay.
Ed, ready?
Okay.
Marco, is it okay if we start with you?
Sure.
Before we do this, I just wanted to tell you something that's coming to me. I had a experience. The first audition I went to in New York, I was very nervous. You know, there were like 200 people auditioning that day. And I remember getting up there to do my piece, and the assistant director, he said, oh, didn't you play Oedipus in a production in Houston? Houston, Texas, about 2 years ago? I said, yes, I did. They said, oh, you were very good in that. I went, wow, this is great. My first edition in New York, and someone already knows my work. Mm-hmm. Who could have arranged that, right? And I got an offer. It was a part that I didn't want. And I said, well, I could take the part and be thankful. Probably other parts might come. Or I could hang out and wait. I went to another audition, so I refused the role. And then I went to another audition, and the there was a young woman, an actress, who she wanted to go in front of me because she was in trouble with another director, and she needed to hurry this up. So I said, oh, sure, go ahead. She went ahead of me, and then I did my audition, and I won that role. It wasn't the role I wanted, but I got it, a good one. And that later I got to talk to the director, and we were hanging out having cocktails after a cast party, whatever. And she said, and we were talking about my audition. She says, well, your audition was pretty good, but that's not why I hired you. And I said, why did you hire me then? She said, because you were so nice to that bitch. And I thought, wow, if I thought I was really hot stuff, I just realized I was just a nice brother gentleman here.
Synchronicity meets chivalry.
So it's like these synchronistic events happen, but they don't tell you what to do with them. You still mm-hmm. have to mm-hmm. figure it out. Here's a sign. Now what do I do with it? But I got the part of Horatio. Forgive me for being a little too long-winded here and a little too theatrical, but I have to quote Hamlet. I didn't get to play Hamlet, but I played a great role, Horatio, who's Hamlet's best friend, and is a very beloved character in that play, because everyone sort of identifies with Horatio. He's like a really nice guy who doesn't talk too much, but he's very devoted and loyal. And I think there's this, and I playing this on stage was such a remarkable experience, because he has a lot of good lines, but I just want to read this brief passage at the end of the play, right before Hamlet walks into a big trap, and there's a conspiracy to kill him. And he's on his way to this experience, and the audience is alerted to the conspiracy. They know what's being planned. And right before this event, he says, thou wouldst not believe, he's talking to Horatio, they're alone on stage. Thou wouldst not think how ill all's here about my heart, but it is no matter. Horatio, nay, good my lord. Hamlet, it is but foolery. It is such a kind of gainsgiving as would perhaps trouble a woman. Horatio, if your mind dislike anything, obey it. I will forestall their repair hither and say you are not fit. Hamlet, not a whit. We defy augury. There is special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be not now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows what is't to leave betimes, let be. I just had to share that with you guys, because he's really, I think Shakespeare's modeling Hamlet, the first modern man, really, according to Howard Bloom. His sense of time. If it be not now, it will be to come. It be not to come. I can't even remember what he says. But the readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows what is't to leave betimes, let be. Very archaic language there, but I think we still can catch the drift. And I think he knows what's going to happen, but he allows it to happen. I think that was his fate. So anyway, guys, I'm ready to do this. Are you all ready?
Yep, sure.
Who wants to go first?
You already drafted Marco.
Marco. Okay. Now I'm going to be
Marco agreed.
If you're not now, it's to come.
The readiness is all, guys.
The readiness is all.
So I'm think about the past. About yesterday, a month ago, a year ago, a decade ago, 2 decades ago, your beginning. If you can point to that past, point to it. Whereabouts is that past?
I can't point to it, John. Would you like me to keep to?
If you can't do that, does it have a size or a shape?
Not exactly.
What kind of past is that past?
The past that I thought about when you asked me to think about it was an imagaic past. Images of aspects of myself or that I could project back or feel back into.
Whereabouts in images?
Well,
your hand.
I am, because it's sort of in the space within me, within my awareness, in my body as well. Certainly, I mean, so with feelings in my body. So as I thought about 20 years ago when I was in college, there was a feeling there.
Is that your left hand?
This is my right hand.
So I beg your pardon. That's your right hand.
Because my left hand is holding open a page from something I wanted to quote earlier. I forgot around to. I might have used my left hand. I do have Italian genetics.
This is a perceptual model. Mm-hmm. It's a see, smell, hear, taste, touch. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at that gesture that you're making with your right hand, and I believe your body knows whereabouts this past is. And I think that's where that's as a model what I'm going for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your future, and you gave it a size and a shape.
Mm-hmm.
And its images and its mix and its feelings, and it was over there on where you were raising your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
If we were in a room together, it'd be much easier. But I see this little this square on my screen, so that's what I'm going with. You and the future. Think about the future.
Hmm.
Whereabouts is that future?
Mm-hmm.
Does that future have a size or a shape?
I'm going to report exactly the image that occurs to me. That's a sort of cataract or waterfall or some kind of onrushing, and it's coming from above down. That's what it feels like.
Above down?
Yes, sort of like this.
A cataract above mm-hmm. down.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything else about that cataract above down?
It has a circular, I'd say, arc to it. So it would almost be cycling like this.
Cycling.
Right. And for anyone listening, I'm coming from above, kind of beyond my head, down and through the body, kind of out the bottom, out into, you know, the ocean of time space.
Beyond your cycling, beyond. Above, beyond your head, and into your body?
Right, through it, I would say.
Through your body.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything else about that future? cascade, circular, above, cyclic, beyond, through.
Oh, there's a lot more about it. I'm afraid of going on too much, though.
Okay. Afraid. Okay. Not too much. Hmm? Where is the present?
Omni. It's omnipresent.
On omni?
Yes.
Whereabouts omni?
Sort of different planes that are, I would correlate with senses. So you said this was perceptual. It's interesting because something that I've been practicing with in a more explicit way recently has been, for lack of what we might call perceptual meditation. And I'll just quickly report what I've been doing because it might tie into this, might be useful. But of course, there are many different methods of meditation or objects of focus in a meditative type of practice, right? It could be your breath, it could be spaciousness, it could be a mantra, whatever. But what I've been doing is paying attention to the sensory experience. So what do you see? What do you taste? What do you smell? What do you feel? And what else is there? And so when one does that and brings attention back from a kind of concept or into an imagining of an object or imagining of a past or present or future to what is actually presenting itself through those different sensory channels, I think something different begins to happen there.
Can you indicate the present? The sensory channels?
Again, I wouldn't really point to it as a specific location. I would more describe it in terms of flows of information or flows of experience.
Flows of information.
Mm-hmm.
And when flows of information, whereabouts flows of information?
Through the body, but the body is not simply the physical appearance of a human, machine or whatever you want to. What's interesting about the perceptual process is that it begins disclosing phenomena that maybe can't be easily categorized as physical or psychic or emotional. It really, phenomena are coalescences of multiple input streams, multiple information channels, you could say. So anything you experience has multi dimensions to it that, if you open the perceptual lenses, allows for a richer object or a richer experience.
And flows through the body.
Mm-hmm.
The richer experience and sensory lenses. And when flows through the body, whereabouts flows through the body?
I'm moving my hands around in a sort of spiral all around because that's where I sense it. And part of what I'm trying to practice is sensing beyond my body, beyond my perceived body.
Okay.
And that's
okay, great. Can we pause?
Sure.
Can we pause there?
Mm-hmm.
That was great. I want you to take paper and make a map of past, present, future in a way that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I hope this demonstration sort of, sometimes it's kind of messy. And sometimes there's concepts and percepts and something that's in between concept and percept, as I believe we observed in Marco and I as we were trying to model his model of the world, his map of time. So I'm inviting this kind of open-ended questions about your language, okay? And I thank you for your patience. And while Mark is doing his map, since you've all gotten a little bit of taste of this,
mm-hmm.
would someone like to go next?
Okay.
Okay. TJ. Okay. Think about your past. Think about a month ago. A decade ago. Mm-hmm. 2 decades ago.
Keep going.
To your beginning. And I'm sure for you, you could go beyond the beginning, but does your past, whereabouts is that past? Can you indicate that?
It's, I guess the best imagery, it's a set of concentric circles. And the farther, it's very spatial, this is all a very spatial metaphor, the farther back in the past I have to reach, the farther away the shell is, and it gets closer and more distinct as it gets closer to me. But it's all in this space, and like, it's all in a bubble around my head.
Whereabouts is that bubble around your head? Can you indicate that?
Within and without.
Within just, and without?
Just around the headspace.
Just around the headspace, a bubble. And does that bubble have a size or a shape?
Size, a disc of like ripples on the surface of a pond, but size? Not really a size, just more the shape and the wave of it.
A disc on the ripples of a pond, a wave?
On the surface of a pond.
And is there anything else about that wave?
To anticipate kind of where we've been, it's centered on the present. So it kind of, it travels with me.
It travels with you.
Yeah. And then images of Doppler shifting and all the rest of it, but yeah.
And the future. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Think about the future. Does that future have a size or a shape?
Always in motion is the future.
Motion? What kind of motion?
The future, curiously enough, is like a, it's not Marco's above downward cataract. It's more like an expanding vortex forward.
Expanding vortex forward. How far forward is that expanding vortex?
It goes on for an indefinite, and it widens as it goes on, and it can be anything.
And it goes on forward, indefinite, and widens as it goes forward? And then what happens?
We'll know as the Doppler moves, you know, along with me further down the cone where it goes. Yeah, it's very spatial. It's very, very spatially organized.
Is there anything else about that future?
Yeah, just wide enough to remain a set of intriguing possibilities.
Thank you. The present. Think about the present. And whereabouts is the present?
The present is located right behind my forehead, between my eyes. And that's the center of all of this swirling and moving and, you know.
And behind the eyes?
Right between the eyes, behind
between the eyes,
yeah, behind my forehead,
and the center of all the swirling. Mm-hmm. And does that center behind the eyes, the center of all that swirling, have a size or a shape?
It's a point, and because it's a point. And because kind of past and future meet up with it, it has zero dimensions itself, but it's there.
a point and past and future meet up. Mm-hmm. And when a point and past and future meet up, is there anything else about that present?
Other than just moving with me in that location.
Moving with you,
yeah,
in that location.
Moving me, moving with me. I move it, you know, so it's a connection there.
A connection there. Is this a good time to pause?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Would you be so kind as to take a paper, make a map of past, present, future in a way that makes sense to you? Okay.
Sure.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, you know, we could go on for hours, really. There's so much material here that each of you are offering me. And because of the time constraints here, I have to sort of constrain myself because my curiosity makes me want to go even deeper. So I apologize. So I'm having to organize my time here. Okay. Here we go. Ed.
Yes, sir.
So you've already had a chance to see our colleagues here explore their maps of the time. Are you ready to go?
Sure.
Great. Think about the past. Whereabouts is that past?
It's in different places. Sometimes I see it out of the corner of my eye.
Which corner of which eye?
It can be either eye, so either corner. Sometimes it's in front of me or behind me. Sometimes, I'll use the metaphor, sometimes the past sneaks up on me from behind. Sometimes it confronts me head on. And then again, sometimes it's merely a peripheral apparition of sorts.
And in a corner of your eye, either eye, front, behind, and past sneaks up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And what determines front, behind, when past sneaks up on you?
I can feel it there.
Feel it there? Whereabouts there?
Behind me.
Ah, okay.
I feel it behind me.
And you
it's
feel
like someone's
it.
Looking over your shoulder kind of thing.
And you feel it as a person looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
When behind you, and you feel it there, does it have a size or a shape?
No shape. No shape. It takes shape.
It takes shape?
It takes shape. And the shape depends on what it is that's coming. You know, you were saying perceptually, I usually don't smell things from like the past. But increasingly, I encounter smells or aromas, and they trigger past things. So it can stimulate. I don't smell my way in, but a smell can bring it on.
And a smell can bring it on.
Oh, yeah.
And is there a smell that can bring it on when behind you and feel, and there's no shape, there's no size?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is there anything else about smell when the past triggers?
Most of them are actually very pleasant. There's a few smells that I've had lately where it triggered, let's say, a pleasant memory. And there was also smells that have triggered what were actually not so pleasant memories, but weren't so bad as memories.
Uh-huh.
You know, the experience was a lot worse than the memory then.
And very pleasant.
Yeah.
Thank you. And the future. Think about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And when think about the future, whereabouts is that future?
Well, it's just like the past. It kind of like pops up all over the place.
It's like the past, and it pops up
It pops up all over the place. You know, to localize, sometimes it's in front of me, you know, Sometimes it comes up behind me. Sometimes I see it out of the corner of my eye, get a glimpse of something, I'll turn my head.
And when it pops up, and you know it's the future, whereabouts pops up?
That's depending on whether where I feel it or see it. So, you know, I don't see things behind me as much as I see things like out here in my peripheral field of vision.
And depends on whether you see or feel it.
Or feel, yeah.
And when you see or feel it and it pops up and it's in front of you, does that have a size or a shape?
No, it takes shape.
It takes
shape depending on what it is that I happen to be encountering. You know, I might see a picture of myself, or I might have a particular feeling about something.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And the present.
Mm-hmm.
About the present. Whereabouts is the present?
It's more hidden than the other two.
More hidden.
Yeah. I kind of wake up to it more than I sense it. You know? And I realize, well, I'm here doing this right now, and it's happens a lot when I'm cooking.
Oh.
I realize I'm standing at the stove and I'm making lunch. Or, well, we just had Thanksgiving. I had to do Thanksgiving. I do Thanksgiving dinner all by myself for the 10 people that are there. And that's a very present moment for me, for example.
And when present,
mm-hmm.
is there anything else about that present?
It's very enlivening.
Very enlivening.
Enlivening, yeah. That's the word. And because it's got all of this, it's got sights, it's got smells, there's sounds, there's things clapping, you know. People are running in and out looking for stuff and asking questions. It's a very dynamic kind of present, that one.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And take a paper.
Okay.
Make a map of past, present, future in a way that makes sense to you.
Okie dokie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So is it okay if you look at your map, Marco? Can you share that with us? How is everybody? Is everyone you're relaxed and alert and everything? Okay. A rich learning experience.
It is. This is good. Yeah, I'm about this movie.
Well, I'm not obviously a visual artist.
A lot better than me.
I'll try to describe various circles. So there's a sort of human figure in the middle, maybe a meditator. So you see the head, body, and the kind of circle around where the legs would be. And then you see the currents coming through from above, down, and from below up. And these, other cycles kind of more circling the entity. But almost gyroscopically, if you would imagine that, spherically, perhaps, would be another way of looking at it, but not a simple sphere, a complex sphere with multiple channels within it or currents that are circumnavigating it. Some of this may be influenced by my recent reading, but I've divided the paper up into past, present, and future with the present in the middle and really the band covering the body. So everything happening in the body present is present oriented. I put the future above, and that's corresponding to what I described earlier as the cascade or the current coming down. And then I put the past below, which I would associate with origin in the Gibserian sense as well, insofar as it's an ever presence, and it's more of a darkness, because the deeper down you go into it, the less precisely perceptible phenomena are.
And currents and multiple channels and future above, present in the middle,
mm-hmm.
past below.
Mm-hmm.
and darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of that, what are you most drawn to?
Well, I'm drawn to the circulation because you don't see it on the paper, but if you were to extend these lines outwards, they would all circle around and come back. And so that's what I'm exploring, is how exactly that works. And, you know, how is it that time is not just a linear back, you know, middle and forward type of experience, but is one that recurs and cycles and also has some emergent quality to it, because this sense of an emergence, the sense of a blossoming or of a unfolding, a revelation, that is part of the experience, I believe. And not just that I believe, that's part of what I'm experiencing.
And emergence and blossoming and unfolding and revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
That's a good question. That's a great question. That's I think part of what is so enticing about the process, is that there is a indeterminacy to what emerges. It's not predictable in a rationalistic manner. It's a surprise. It's meant to be a surprise. If we knew what it was, then there wouldn't be a point necessarily to the experience.
Is it okay if we pause?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Let's see, who goes in? TJ? And we're all going to look at everyone's map, and then we're going to open it up to free-for-all, all over the place sort of summary, okay? Just to let you know what the pace is. So we're at 4:30. Is that okay? Are we over our time? Or
we're over. It doesn't matter.
It's okay. Yeah, are you guys ready?
You know, we've been tending to go over the last couple
of calls. So I think 20 more minutes. Will we have 20 minutes to do this?
Yes, and that's actually all I have, because I have another appointment at the top of the hour.
I'll try to be mindful of that. Thank you. Okay. TJ?
I don't know if you can see it. Did I write that dark enough?
I can see it. Ooh. Yes, that's okay. Perfect.
Okay. So, like I said, we just kind of have this pool of memories that's represented as the past, focused on a present moment, and then expanding out into a future. And I kind of, I don't know if I put the swirls in there. Just like the past memories, you know, some are sharper than others, some are not. And then the future is not a deterministic. There's a linear and spatial aspect of this whole model, but it's not, you know, I don't know which direction this future is actually, you know, going to take. And like Marco said, what would be the point if I did? So
what are you most drawn to?
The fact that because I'm moving, this is two dimensional. So this is actually, it should be forward. I put forward as up. And the fact that I'm kind of taking the swirling of the past with me into the future as I go, as part of the swirl, just, you know, thinking about things and how they affect other things is part of it. The connectivity of it all.
Connectivity.
You know, I mean, I'm saying past, present, and future, but it's just really, it's all connected. And it all influences. I take the influences with me as I travel, which is why it kind of ripples out behind me and cones and vortexes in front.
Thank you very much. I regret, and of course, this is what you said about time, Ed. We never have enough of it, because I really wish we
could watch. Speaking of time.
there's so much richness there that I'd like to tease out. But anyway, moving on to Ed. Do you have your map? Can you show us?
I have a map.
Okay, cool.
I don't know where's the best place to put this, that you can see it.
I can see it. That's good.
Yeah, it was good.
Okay. So what I have in there is the three X, Y, and Z axes. They're in different colors, which you won't be able to discern as much. But so imagine a three-dimensional coordinate system, since John was asking a lot about locations. And these past events that appear are in green, and the present ones are circled P's, and the futures are the red. And some of them have rays of light because they're visual. Some of them have a heart because it's a feeling I have. Some of them have those little wiggly lines to go up because there would be smells perhaps or tastes involved and that kind of thing. And then they're kind of like dotted or dashed lines connecting various events, because it's not sometimes a past, a memory will come that will trigger a thought about today or maybe even something about the future. And sometimes I see things, I see things in the future. I'm not a visionary, believe me. But there are like potentials that could come to be.
You're not a visionary?
No, I don't consider myself.
Don't believe you. Because that map looks like the map of a visionary to me. Pardon me, that wasn't a good
one. I'm having trouble calling it a map. But anyway, because that's this whole thing. They just kind of like pop up. And then they're there, and then I can follow it for a while, and then, you know, they'll become more intense. Things in the past when the visual tend to be more black and white.
In the past, more black and white?
Yeah. Well, my this is also a follow-on, because my children think I grew up in a Technicolor childhood because it was 1950s, and I thought everything was black and white back then. And it was actually very, very disturbingly black and white. No. I didn't see a color TV until I was like 14 years old. So,
wow,
that kind of thing. But anyhow, that's how my map kind of functions. It's kind of there, and it's not. And yeah, we kind of go with what's there.
Right. Yeah. Is it okay if we pause?
Sure. Oh yeah.
Thank you very much, guys. I'm just going to turn on the light because it's getting dark here. Okay. So we finished this modeling process, and I hope it was useful. It was certainly useful for me. Mm-hmm. The big challenge, but I think it's very important as we, I have my model of the world, or my map. Mm-hmm. Each of you have your map. And the research question is, I can't know anything about our map unless I know what your map is. Mm-hmm. You know what my map is. And then what emerges out of that investigation? And I'm very interested in the phenomenological investigation, because we can come up with meta theories and string theory and off we go. Mm-hmm. But as we've all expressed a concern about, you know, how we're going to work with this. So it's an open question. And so I'm really curious about, if there's anything that you learned today from this process that you would like to share with the group, I would be very grateful. So maybe we could just go around and ask, is there anything you learned from this process or this conversation today?
Time's not simple. All of our maps have a dynamism to them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Time's not simple, and all of our maps have a dynamism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know I'm coming from where the historian comes from, and it's real, you know, a very linear and arrow, but even that is a swirling mess of all kinds of images and things.
A swirling mess. Marco, Ed, would you like to share something you learned today? Oh, beg your pardon. Can I go back to TJ? Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you, is there an action that you can take that will honor this learning? You don't have to come up with it right away. I'm just asking this like an assignment. Mm-hmm. Could you come up with an action? Yeah, I'm going to ask each of you to find a learning and come up with an action. If you can come up with an action, you can share it online. Or between now and our next event, I think we could start to then open ourselves up to evidence. You know, can we work with serendipity and synchronicity? Because, you know, all kinds of things can happen between now and the next time we have an infinite conversation. So that's my logic here. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a paraconsistent logic, because we're dealing with a mess.
I don't have a specific action, but it is going to deal with, you brought up, how do we construct it, collective maps without, and that's kind of my whole thing about cultural configurations and time and everything. So it's along those lines. I don't know exactly what the action is yet. But
well, I'd be very grateful if you, yeah. You don't know what that action is, but if you could intend to find an action, not to solve the world's problems, but just to have an action that honors what you've learned.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think that Gebser called that concrescence. I think that's what concrescence.
I think that's what he means.
Yeah. Anybody else have a learning, Marco or Ed?
I found it an extremely challenging exercise because I don't really think about time all that much spatially. You know, I understand the arrow thing, and I really like the circle thing and the magical and mystical, but. And sometimes it's like that and sometimes it isn't. So this was, for me, a very stimulating exercise to try to put into a spatialized map, because I got to draw it on a two-dimensional piece of paper, something that isn't actually suited to a two-dimensional piece of paper. That was a challenge for me. But then drawing anything is a challenge for me.
That's why I said make a map.
Yeah, I know you said make a map.
Or a diagram or a sketch. You know? and once again, if you could come up with a learning.
Yeah, okay. I wrote that down. I figured you were going to pass that on. I was getting off the hook.
Because I'm aware of the time frame here. And I know you have to do something, Marco. So I want to respect you have to run and do that. But if you can come up with something you learned today, would you like to share?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. I thought Ed needed to have an action.
I wrote down that thing. I need to.
Yeah. Come oh, okay. Up with so your action is to come up with an action.
Well, that can be.
I'm the slow guy. I'm the old guy. I'm the slowest. Okay.
That's a follow up. Okay. If you want to participate.
Oh man, this is so odd for me. I have to say, because I'm obsessed by space and time. Like when I have free time and personal space,
mm-hmm.
I spend that time and I occupy that space contemplating the space and time itself. So, and that is a theme in my poetry, what I write about. What I read about, and like I said, like when I'm alone, that's where my mind tends to go, is into what's really happening here, what's the dimensionality of this, how does this all work? And so I'm constantly kind of a little bit out of step with consensus reality. And
you're not missing anything.
that interplay between sort of what I sense is more true, and or how it might be more true, and then what appears to be kind of the way that things work or the way that things are operationalized, the gap between what could be operationalized, which isn't, and what is operationalized that really shouldn't be, is sort of where the tension is, I think, and where my field of action would be. And right now, my most important action, and this is not new, but it's new to the conversation, is to stay present and to keep paying attention. And particularly with my body, particularly with the sensory channels and the information flows, it's becoming, I'm more and more acutely aware of the limitations that are, and where they might be coming from. And I think sensitive to how I could loosen those up a bit, open up a bit more. I think that there's a lot that I'm just missing because the body itself, out of habit, out of pattern, out of defense, out of fear, out of, you know, post-trauma, whatever number of other factors, is more constricted than it really needs to be. It could be more open. There could be a more throughput, if you will, of these multi-dimensional information flows. And you can't just go from closed to open immediately because there's a structural aspect to it. And that's that the structures themselves have to be able to endure those flows. If they can't, then the being will be kind of messed up by it. And so that's an ongoing learning, is I think all I could say about that. And I'm aware as well that I probably need some help. that I can't do it all by myself sitting in my room here. Mm.
I wanted to add something. I didn't get to ask this question, but maybe next time we can do a clean start where I could like ask each person, what kind of support do you need? Mm. Or what resources do you have that you want to develop? Because I think that's very important, that we get the support that we need. And I know I need a lot of support. And what I want, and I wanted to, this may be for a future discussion, but I think the idea of action plans, where I think we have resistance to them if we've been terribly disappointed by actions that we've taken, they've fallen apart. So we don't make any plans. I think that's part of the postmodern drift. And I'm very resistant to that myself, because probably I've been disappointed so many times. And I'm sort of saying, you know, I don't want to do this action plan that a lot of our time management courses are in, you know, and I'm really into finding an action that honors the learning. It could be a gesture, it could be a dance, it could be lots of different things. But it's much more of can you create a ritual? And for me, I just was aware as I was listening to all the different kind of learnings here, I want to make a Klein bottle. I know I can do a Mobius strip. That's pretty easy. I could even do a limnoscape. You know, once you make the Mobius strip, all you have to do is cut it down the middle and it turns into a limnoscape. But I think I sort of need to make a Klein bottle. It doesn't even have to be, you know, it could be made out of cardboard. So that's my commitment. That's the action that I want to take that will honor the learning that I've enjoyed today with all of you guys. Deep bows to everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
No, thank you, John. That was a very stimulating experience again. Right?
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to viewing this video when you post it, Marco, because then I can start going to a meta level.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there's so much that happened that I was totally missing.
All right. Well, I'll post it as soon as I can.
All right.
Colorado All right. time. Course.
whatever that is.
How poor are they that have not patience? Thank you, guys.
All right.
All right, guys.
Take care.
Take care.
Till next time, huh?
Yep.